Chapter 7 Poirot Pays His Debts. As we came out of the Stylites' arms, Poirot drew me aside by a gentle pressure of the arm. I understood his object. He was waiting for the Scotland Yard men. In a few moments they emerged, and Poirot at once stepped forward and accosted the shorter of the two.
"I fear you do not remember me, Inspector Japp."
"Why? If it isn't Monsieur Poirot," cried the inspector. He turned to the other man. "You've heard me speak of Monsieur Poirot. It was in 1904 he and I worked together. The Abercrombie forgery case. You remember? He was run down in Brussels. Ah, those were great days, monsieur. Then do you remember Baron Altara? There was a pretty rogue for you. He eluded the clutches of half the police in Europe. But we nailed him in Antwerp, thanks to Monsieur Poirot here." As these friendly reminiscences were being indulged in, I drew nearer and was introduced to Detective Inspector Japp, who in his turn introduced us both to his companion, Superintendent Summerhay.
"I need hardly ask what you are doing here, gentlemen," remarked Poirot.
Japp closed one eye knowingly. "No, indeed. Pretty clear case, I should say." But Poirot answered him gravely.
"There, I differ from you."
"Oh, come," said Summerhay, opening his lips for the first time. "Surely the whole thing is clear as daylight. The man's caught red-handed. How he could be such a fool beats me." But Japp was looking attentively at Poirot. "Hold your fire, Summerhay," he remarked jocularly. "Me and Monsieur here have met before, and there's no man's judgment I'd sooner take than his. If I'm not greatly mistaken, he's got something up his sleeve. Isn't that so, Monsieur?"
Poirot smiled. "I have drawn certain conclusions, yes."
Summerhay was still looking rather sceptical, but Japp continued his scrutiny of Poirot. "It's this way," he said. "So far, we've only seen the case from the outside. That's where the Yard's at a disadvantage in a case of this kind. Where the murder's only out, so to speak, after the inquest. A lot depends on being on the spot first thing, and that's where Monsieur Poirot's had the start of us. We shouldn't have been here as soon as this, even, if it hadn't been for the fact that there was a smart doctor on the spot who gave us the tip through the coroner. But you've been on the spot from the first, and you may have picked up some little hints. From the evidence at the inquest, Mr. Inglethorpe murdered his wife as sure as I stand here, and if anyone but you hinted the contrary, I'd laugh in his face. I must say I was surprised the jury didn't bring it in willful murder against him right off. I think they would have, if it hadn't been for the coroner. He seemed to be holding them back."
"Perhaps, though, you have a warrant for his arrest in your pocket now," suggested Poirot.
A kind of wooden shutter of officialdom came down over Japp's expressive countenance. "Perhaps I have, and perhaps I haven't," he remarked dryly. Poirot looked at him thoughtfully.
"I am very anxious, monsieur, that he should not be arrested."
"I dare say," observed Summerhay sarcastically. Japp was regarding Poirot with comical perplexity. "Can't you go a little further, Monsieur Poirot? A wink's as good as a nod, from you. You've been on the spot, and the Yard doesn't want to make any mistakes, you know."
Poirot nodded gravely. "That is exactly what I thought. Well, I will tell you this. Use your warrant, arrest Mr. Inglethorpe, but it will bring you no kudos. The case against him will be dismissed at once, comme ça."
And he snapped his fingers expressively. Japp's face grew grave, though Summerhay gave an incredulous snort. As for me, I was literally dumb with astonishment. I could only conclude that Poirot was mad. Japp had taken out a handkerchief and was gently dabbing his brow. "I daren't do it, Monsieur Poirot. I'd take your word, but there's others over me who'll be asking what the devil I mean by it. Can't you give me a little more to go on?" Poirot reflected a moment.
"It can be done," he said at last. "I admit I do not wish it. It forces my hand. I would have preferred to work in the dark just for the present. But what you say is very just. The word of a Belgian policeman whose day is past is not enough. And Alfred Inglethorpe must not be arrested. That I have sworn, as my friend Hastings here knows. See then, my good Japp, you go at once to Stiles?"
"Well, in about half an hour, we're seeing the coroner and the doctor first."
"Good. Call for me in passing. The last house in the village. I will go with you. At Stiles, Mr. Inglethorpe will give you, or if he refuses, as is probable, I will give you such proofs that shall satisfy you that the case against him could not possibly be sustained. Is that a bargain?
That's a bargain, said Jap heartily, and on behalf of the Yard I'm much obliged to you, though I'm bound to confess I can't at present see the faintest possible loophole in the evidence, but you always were a marvel. So long then, monsieur.
The two detectives strode away, Summerhay with an incredulous grin on his face.
Well, my friend, cried Poirot, before I could get in a word, what do you think?
Mon Dieu, I had some warm moments in that court. I did not figure to myself that the man would be so pig-headed as to refuse to say anything at all. Decidedly, it was the policy of an imbecile.
There are other explanations besides that of imbecility, I remarked, for if the case against him is true, how could he defend himself except by silence?
Why, in a thousand ingenious ways, cried Poirot.
See, say that it is I who have committed this murder. I can think of 7 most plausible stories, far more convincing than Mr. Inglethorpe's stony denials.
I could not help laughing. My dear Poirot, I'm sure you are capable of thinking of 70. But seriously, in spite of what I heard you say to detectives, you surely cannot still believe in the possibility of Alfred Inglethorpe's innocence.
Why not now as much as before? Nothing has changed.
But the evidence is so conclusive.
Yes, too conclusive.
We turned in at the gate of Leastways Cottage and proceeded up the now familiar stairs.
Yes, yes, too conclusive, continued Poirot, almost to himself. Real evidence is usually vague and unsatisfactory. It has to be examined, sifted. But here the whole thing is cut and dried.
No, my friend. This evidence has been very cleverly manufactured. So cleverly that it has defeated its own ends.
Well, how do you make that out?
Because as long as the evidence against him was vague and intangible, it was very hard to disprove. But in his anxiety, the criminal has drawn the net so closely that one cut will set Inglethorpe free.
I was silent. And in a minute or two, Poirot continued.
Let us look at the matter like this. Here is a man, let us say, who sets out to poison his wife. He has lived by his wits, as the saying goes. Presumably, therefore, he has some wits. He is not altogether a fool. Well, how does he set about it? He goes boldly to the village chemist's and purchases strychnine under his own name, with a trumped-up story about a dog which is bound to prove absurd. He does not employ the poison that night, no. He waits until he has had a violent quarrel with her, of which the whole household is cognizant, and which naturally directs their suspicions upon him. He prepares no defense, no shadow of an alibi, yet he knows the chemist's assistant must necessarily come forward with the facts.
Bah! Do not ask me to believe that any man could be so idiotic. Only a lunatic who wished to commit suicide by causing himself to be hanged would act so.
Still, I do not see, I began, neither do I see. I tell you, mon ami, it puzzles me.
Me? Hercule Poirot!
But if you believe him innocent, how do you explain his buying the strychnine?
Very simply. He did not buy it.
But Mace recognized him.
I beg your pardon.
He saw a man with a black beard like Mr. Inglethorpe's and wearing glasses like Mr. Inglethorpe, and dressed in Mr. Inglethorpe's rather noticeable clothes. He could not recognize a man whom he had probably only seen in the distance, since, you remember, he himself had only been in the village a fortnight, and Mrs. Inglethorpe dealt principally with Coutts in Tadminster.
Then you think, mon ami, do you remember the 2 points I laid stress upon?
Leave the first one for the moment. What was the second?
The important fact that Alfred Inglethorpe wears peculiar clothes, has a black beard, and uses glasses, I quoted.
Exactly. Now, suppose anyone wished to pass himself off as John or Lawrence Cavendish. Would it be easy?
No, I said thoughtfully. Of course, an actor.
But Poirot cut me short ruthlessly. And why would it not be easy? I will tell you, my friend.
Because they are both clean-shaven men. To make up successfully as one of these two in broad daylight, it would need an actor of genius, and a certain initial facial resemblance. But in the case of Alfred Inglethorpe, all that is changed. His clothes, his beard,
The glasses, which hide his eyes. Those are the salient points about his personal appearance. Now, what is the first instinct of the criminal? To divert suspicion from himself, is it not so? And how can he best do that? By throwing it on someone else. In this instance, there was a man ready to his hand. Everybody was predisposed to believe in Mr. Inglethorpe's guilt. It was a foregone conclusion that he would be suspected, but to make it a sure thing, there must be tangible proof, such as the actual buying of the poison. And that, with a man of the peculiar appearance of Mr. Inglethorpe, was not difficult. Remember, this young Mace had never actually spoken to Mr. Inglethorpe. How should he doubt that the man in his clothes, with his beard and his glasses, was not Alfred Inglethorpe? It may be so, I said, fascinated by Poirot's eloquence. But if that was the case, why does he not say where he was at 6 o'clock on Monday evening? Ah, why indeed, said Poirot, calming down. If he were arrested, he probably would speak. But I do not want it to come to that. I must make him see the gravity of his position. There is, of course, something discreditable behind his silence. If he did not murder his wife, he is nevertheless a scoundrel, and has something of his own to conceal, quite apart from the murder. What can it be? I mused, won over to Poirot's views for the moment, although still retaining a faint conviction that the obvious deduction was the correct one. Can you not guess? Asked Poirot, smiling. No. Can you? Oh, yes. I had a little idea some time ago, and it has turned out to be correct. Well, you never told me, I said reproachfully. Poirot spread out his hands apologetically. Pardon me, mon ami. You were not precisely sympathique. He turned to me earnestly. Tell me. You see now that he must not be arrested. Perhaps, I said doubtfully, for I was really indifferent to the fate of Alfred Inglethorpe, and thought that a good fright would do him no harm. Poirot, who was watching me intently, gave a sigh. Come, my friend, he said, changing the subject. Apart from Mr. Inglethorpe, how did the evidence at the inquest strike you? Oh, pretty much what I expected. Did nothing strike you as peculiar about it? My thoughts flew to Mary Cavendish, and I hedged. In what way? Well, Mr. Lawrence Cavendish's evidence, for instance. I was relieved. Oh, Lawrence! No, I don't think so. He's always a nervous chap. His suggestion that his mother might have been poisoned accidentally by means of the tonic she was taking. That did not strike you as strange, huh? No, I can't say it did. The doctors ridiculed it, of course, but it was quite a natural suggestion for a layman to make. But Monsieur Lawrence is not a layman. You told me yourself that he had started by studying medicine, and that he had taken his degree. Well, yes, that's true. I never thought of that. I was rather startled. It is odd. Poirot nodded. From the first, his behavior has been peculiar. Of all the household, he alone would be likely to recognize the symptoms of strychnine poisoning, and yet we find him the only member of the family to uphold strenuously the theory of death from natural causes. If it had been Monsieur John, I could have understood it. He has no technical knowledge, and is by nature unimaginative. But Monsieur Lawrence, no. And now, today, he puts forward a suggestion that he himself must have known was ridiculous. There is food for thought in this, mon ami. It's very confusing, I agreed. Then there is Mrs. Cavendish, continued Poirot. That is another who is not telling all she knows. What do you make of her attitude? I don't know what to make of it. It seems inconceivable that she should be shielding Alfred Inglethorpe, yet that is what it looks like. Poirot nodded reflectively. Yes, it is queer. One thing is certain. She overheard a good deal more of that private conversation than she was willing to admit. And yet she is the last person one would accuse of stooping to eavesdrop. Exactly. One thing her evidence has shown me. I made a mistake. Dorcas was quite right. The quarrel did take place earlier in the afternoon, about 4 o'clock, as she said. I looked at him curiously. I had never understood his insistence on that point. Yes, a good deal that was peculiar came out today, continued Poirot. Dr. Bauerstein, now. What was he doing? Up and dressed at that hour in the morning. It is astonishing to me that no one commented on the fact. He has insomnia, I believe, I said doubtfully, which is a very good or a very bad explanation, remarked Poirot. It covers everything and explains nothing. I shall keep my eye on our clever Dr. Bauerstein. Any more faults to find with the evidence? I inquired satirically.
Mon ami, replied Poirot gravely.
When you find that people are not telling you the truth, look out. Now, unless I am much mistaken, at this inquest today, only one, at most two persons, were speaking the truth without reservation or subterfuge. Oh, come now, Poirot. I won't cite Lawrence or Mrs. Cavendish, but there's John and Miss Howard. Surely they were speaking the truth. Both of them, my friend? One, I grant you, but both? His words gave me an unpleasant shock. Miss Howard's evidence, unimportant as it was, had been given in such a downright straightforward manner that it had never occurred to me to doubt her sincerity. Still, I had a great respect for Poirot's sagacity, except on the occasions when he was what I described to myself as foolishly pig-headed. "Do you really think so?" I asked. Miss Howard had always seemed to me so essentially honest, almost uncomfortably so. Poirot gave me a curious look, which I could not quite fathom. He seemed about to speak and then checked himself. "Miss Murdoch, too," I continued. "There's nothing untruthful about her." "No, but it was strange that she never heard a sound, sleeping next door, whereas Mrs. Cavendish in the other wing of the building distinctly heard the table fall." "Well, she's young, and she sleeps soundly."
"Ah, yes, indeed.
She must be a famous sleeper, that one." I did not quite like the tone of his voice, but at that moment a smart knock reached our ears, and looking out of the window we perceived the two detectives waiting for us below. Poirot seized his hat, gave a ferocious twist to his moustache, and carefully brushing an imaginary speck of dust from his sleeve, motioned me to precede him down the stairs. There we joined the detectives, and set out for Stiles. I think the appearance of the two Scotland Yard men was rather a shock, especially to John, though of course after the verdict he had realized that it was only a matter of time. Still, the presence of the detectives brought the truth home to him more than anything else could have done. Poirot had conferred with Japp in a low tone on the way up, and it was the latter functionary who requested that the household, with the exception of the servants, should be assembled together in the drawing-room. I realized the significance of this. It was up to Poirot to make his boast good. Personally, I was not sanguine. Poirot might have excellent reasons for his belief in Inglethorpe's innocence, but a man of the type of Summerhay would require tangible proofs, and these I doubted if Poirot could supply. Before very long, we had all trooped into the drawing-room, the door of which Japp closed. Poirot politely set chairs for everyone. The Scotland Yard men were the cynosure of all eyes. I think that for the first time we realized that the thing was not a bad dream, but a tangible reality. We had read of such things. Now we ourselves were actors in the drama. Tomorrow the daily papers all over England would blazon out the news in staring headlines. "Mysterious tragedy in Sussex. Wealthy lady poisoned." There would be pictures of Stiles, snapshots of the family leaving the inquest. The village photographer had not been idle. All the things that one had read 100 times, things that happened to other people, not to oneself. And now, in this house, a murder had been committed. In front of us were the detectives in charge of the case. The well-known glib phraseology passed rapidly through my mind in the interval before Poirot opened the proceedings. I think everyone was a little surprised that it should be he, and not one of the official detectives, who took the initiative.
"Mesdames et messieurs," said Poirot, bowing as though he were a celebrity about to deliver a lecture, "I have asked you to come here all together for a certain object. That object? It concerns Mr. Alfred Inglethorpe."
Inglethorpe was sitting a little by himself. I think unconsciously everyone had drawn his chair slightly away from him, and he gave a faint start as Poirot pronounced his name.
"Mr. Inglethorpe," said Poirot, addressing him directly, "a very dark shadow is resting on this house. The shadow of murder."
Inglethorpe shook his head sadly. "My poor wife," he murmured. "Poor Emily. It is terrible."
"I do not think, monsieur," said Poirot pointedly, "that you quite realize how terrible it may be for you."
And as Inglethorpe did not appear to understand, he added, "Mr. Inglethorpe, you are standing in very grave danger." The two detectives fidgeted. "I saw the official caution. Anything you say will be used in evidence against you," actually hovering on Summerhay's lips. Poirot went on, "Do you understand now, monsieur?"
"No. What do you mean?"
"I mean," said Poirot deliberately, "that you are suspected of poisoning your wife."
A little gasp ran round the circle at this plain speaking.
"Good heavens!" cried Inglethorpe, starting up. "What a monstrous idea! I? Poison my dearest Emily?"
"I do not think," Poirot watched him narrowly, "that you quite realize the unfavorable nature of your evidence at the inquest. Mr. Inglethorpe, knowing what I have now told you, do you still refuse to say where you were at 6 o'clock on Monday afternoon?"
With a groan, Alfred Inglethorpe sank down again and buried his face in his hands. Poirot approached and stood over him.
"Speak!" he cried menacingly.
With an effort, Inglethorpe raised his face from his hands. Then, slowly and deliberately, he shook his head.
"You will not speak?" "No. I do not believe that anyone could be so monstrous as to accuse me of what you say."
Poirot nodded thoughtfully, like a man whose mind is made up.
"Soit," he said. "Then I must speak for you."
Alfred Inglethorpe sprang up again.
"You? How can you speak? You do not know—"
He broke off abruptly. Poirot turned to face us.
"Mesdames et messieurs, I speak.
Listen. I, Hercule Poirot, affirm that the man who entered the chemist's shop and purchased strychnine at 6 o'clock on Monday last was not Mr. Inglethorpe. For at 6 o'clock on that day, Mr. Inglethorpe was escorting Mrs. Rakes back to her home from a neighboring farm. I can produce no less than 5 witnesses to swear to having seen them together, either at 6 or just after. And as you may know, the Abbey Farm, Mrs. Rakes's home, is at least 2.5 miles distant from the village. There is absolutely no question as to the alibi."
Chapter 8. Fresh Suspicions. There was a moment's stupefied silence. Jap, who was the least surprised of any of us, was the first to speak.
"My word," he cried. "You're the goods, and no mistake, Monsieur Poirot. These witnesses of yours are all right, I suppose?"
"Voilà. I have prepared a list of them, names and addresses. You must see them, of course, but you will find it all right."
"I'm sure of that." Jap lowered his voice. "I'm much obliged to you. A pretty mare's nest arresting him would have been." He turned to Inglethorpe. "But if you'll excuse me, sir, why couldn't you say all this at the inquest?"
"I will tell you why," interrupted Poirot. "There was a certain rumour—"
"A most malicious and utterly untrue one," interrupted Alfred Inglethorpe in an agitated voice.
"And Mr. Inglethorpe was anxious to have no scandal revived just at present. Am I right?"
"Quite right," Inglethorpe nodded. "With my poor Emily not yet buried, can you wonder I was anxious that no more lying rumours should be started?"
"Between you and me, sir," remarked Jap, "I'd sooner have any amount of rumours than be arrested for murder. And I venture to think that your poor lady would have felt the same. And if it hadn't been for Monsieur Poirot here, arrested you would have been as sure as eggs is eggs."
"I was foolish, no doubt," murmured Inglethorpe. "But you do not know, Inspector, how I have been persecuted and maligned." And he shot a baleful glance at Evelyn Howard. "Now, sir," said Jap, turning briskly to John, "I should like to see the lady's bedroom, please, and after that I'll have a little chat with the servants. Don't you bother about anything. Monsieur Poirot here will show me the way."
As they all went out of the room, Poirot turned and made me a sign to follow him upstairs. There he caught me by the arm and drew me aside.
"Quick, go to the other wing. Stand there, just this side of the baize door. Do not move till I come.
Then, turning rapidly, he rejoined the two detectives. I followed his instructions, taking up my position by the baize door, and wondering what on earth lay behind the request. Why was I to stand in this particular spot on guard? I looked thoughtfully down the corridor in front of me. An idea struck me. With the exception of Cynthia Murdoch's, every room was in this left wing. Had that anything to do with it? Was I to report who came or went? I stood faithfully at my post. The minutes passed. Nobody came. Nothing happened. It must have been quite 20 minutes before Poirot rejoined me.
You have not stirred?
No. I've stuck here like a rock. Nothing's happened.
Ah!
Was he pleased or disappointed?
You've seen nothing at all?
No.
But you have probably heard something. A big bump, eh, mon ami?
No.
Is it possible? Ah, but I am vexed with myself.
I am not usually clumsy. I made but a slight gesture. I know Poirot's gestures. With the left hand and overwent the table by the bed. He looked so childishly vexed and crestfallen that I hastened to console him. Oh, never mind, old chap. What does it matter? Your triumph downstairs excited you. I can tell you, that was a surprise to us all. There must be more in this affair of Inglethorpe's with Mrs. Raikes than we thought, to make him hold his tongue so persistently. What are you going to do now? Where are the Scotland Yard fellows?
Gone down to interview the servants.
I showed them all our exhibits. I am disappointed in Jap.
He has no method.
Hello, I said, looking out of the window. Here's Dr. Bauerstein. I believe you're right about that man, Poirot. I don't like him.
He is clever, observed Poirot meditatively.
Oh, clever as the devil. I must say I was overjoyed to see him in the plight he was in on Tuesday. You never saw such a spectacle. And I described the doctor's adventure. He looked a regular scarecrow, plastered with mud from head to foot.
You saw him then?
Yes, of course. He didn't want to come in. It was just after dinner, but Mr. Inglethorpe insisted.
What?
Poirot caught me violently by the shoulders.
Was Dr. Bauerstein here on Tuesday evening?
Here?
And you never told me? Why did you not tell me? Why?
He appeared to be in an absolute frenzy.
My dear Poirot, I expostulated, I never thought it would interest you.
I didn't know it was of any importance.
Importance? It is of the first importance. So, Dr. Bauerstein was here on Tuesday night, the night of the murder. Hastings, do you not see? That alters everything, everything.
I'd never seen him so upset. Loosening his hold of me, he mechanically straightened a pair of candlesticks, still murmuring to himself,
Yes, that alters everything, everything.
Suddenly, he seemed to come to a decision.
Allons, he said. We must act at once. Where is Mr. Cavendish?
John was in the smoking room. Poirot went straight to him.
Mr. Cavendish, I have some important business in Tadminster. A new clue. May I take your motor?
Oh, why, of course. Do you mean at once?
If you please.
John rang the bell and ordered round the car. In another 10 minutes we were racing down the park and along the high road to Tadminster. Now, Poirot, I remarked resignedly, perhaps you will tell me what this is all about.
Well, mon ami, a good deal you can guess for yourself. Of course, you realize that now Mr. Inglethorpe is out of it, the whole position is greatly changed. We are face to face with an entirely new problem. We know now that there is one person who did not buy the poison. We have cleared away the manufactured clues. Now for the real ones. I have ascertained that anyone in the household, with the exception of Mrs. Cavendish, who was playing tennis with you, could have personated Mr. Inglethorpe on Monday evening. In the same way, we have his statement that he put the coffee down in the hall. No one took much notice of that at the inquest, but now it has a very different significance. We must find out who did take that coffee to Mrs. Inglethorpe eventually, or who passed through the hall whilst it was standing there. From your account, there are only two people whom we can positively say did not go near the coffee. Mrs. Cavendish and Mademoiselle Cynthia.
Yes, that is so. I felt an inexpressible lightening of the heart. Mary Cavendish could certainly not rest under suspicion. "In clearing Alfred Inglethorpe," continued Poirot, "I have been obliged to show my hand sooner than I intended. As long as I might be thought to be pursuing him, the criminal would be off his guard. Now he will be doubly careful. Yes, doubly careful." He turned to me abruptly. "Tell me, Hastings, you yourself, have you no suspicions of anybody?" I hesitated. To tell the truth, an idea, wild and extravagant in itself, had once or twice that morning flashed through my brain. I had rejected it as absurd. Nevertheless, it persisted. "Well, you couldn't call it a suspicion," I murmured. "It's so utterly foolish." "Come now," urged Poirot encouragingly. "Do not fear. Speak your mind. You should always pay attention to your instincts." "Well, then," I blurted out, "it's absurd, but I suspect Miss Howard of not telling all she knows."
"Miss Howard?"
"Yes, you'll laugh at me."
"Not at all. Why should I?"
"I can't help feeling," I continued blunderingly, "that we've rather left her out of the possible suspects, simply on the strength of her having been away from the place. But after all, she was only 15 miles away. A car would do it in half an hour. Can we say positively that she was away from Stiles on the night of the murder?" "Yes, my friend," said Poirot unexpectedly, "we can. One of my first actions was to ring up the hospital where she was working."
"Well?"
"Well, I learned that Miss Howard had been on afternoon duty on Tuesday, and that a convoy coming in unexpectedly, she had kindly offered to remain on night duty, which offer was gratefully accepted. That disposes of that."
"Oh," I said, rather nonplussed. "Really," I continued, "it's her extraordinary vehemence against Inglethorpe that started me off suspecting her. I can't help feeling that she'd do anything against him. And I had an idea she might know something about the destroying of the will. She might have burnt the new one, mistaking it for the earlier one in his favor. She's so terribly bitter against him."
"You consider her vehemence unnatural?"
"Yes. She is so very violent. I wonder, really, whether she is quite sane on that point."
Poirot shook his head energetically. "No, no, you are on a wrong track there. There is nothing weak-minded or degenerate about Miss Howard. She is an excellent specimen of well-balanced English beef and brawn. She is sanity itself."
"Yet her hatred of Inglethorpe seems almost a mania. My idea was, a very ridiculous one, no doubt, that she had intended to poison him, and that, in some way, Mrs. Inglethorpe got hold of it by mistake. But I don't at all see how it could have been done. The whole thing is absurd and ridiculous to the last degree.
Still, you are right in one thing. It is always wise to suspect everybody until you can prove logically and to your own satisfaction that they are innocent. Now, what reasons are there against Miss Howard's having deliberately poisoned Mrs. Inglethorpe?"
"Why, she was devoted to her," I exclaimed.
"Tza-tza," cried Poirot irritably. "You argue like a child. If Miss Howard were capable of poisoning the old lady, she would be quite equally capable of simulating devotion. No. We must look elsewhere. You are perfectly correct in your assumption that her vehemence against Alfred Inglethorpe is too violent to be natural, but you are quite wrong in the deduction you draw from it. I have drawn my own deductions, which I believe to be correct, but I will not speak of them at present." He paused a minute, then went on. "Now, to my way of thinking, there is one insuperable objection to Miss Howard's being the murderess. And that is, that in no possible way could Mrs. Inglethorpe's death benefit Miss Howard. Now, there is no murder without a motive." I reflected. "Could not Mrs. Inglethorpe have made a will in her favor?" Poirot shook his head. "But you yourself suggested that possibility to Mr. Wells." Poirot smiled. "That was for a reason. I did not want to mention the name of the person who was actually in my mind. Miss Howard occupied very much the same position, so I used her name instead."
"Still, Mrs. Inglethorpe might have done so. Why, that will made on the afternoon of her death may—"
But Poirot's shake of the head was so energetic that I stopped. "No, my friend. I have certain little ideas of my own about that will. but I can tell you this much. It was not in Miss Howard's favour. I accepted his assurance, though I did not really see how he could be so positive about the matter. Well, I said with a sigh, we will acquit Miss Howard. It is partly your fault that I ever came to suspect her. It was what you said about her evidence at the inquest that set me off. Poirot looked puzzled. What did I say about her evidence at the inquest? Well, don't you remember? When I cited her and John Cavendish as being above suspicion.
Oh.
Ah. Yes. He seemed a little confused, but recovered himself. By the way, Hastings, there is something I want you to do for me.
Oh, certainly. What is it?
Next time you happen to be alone with Lawrence Cavendish, I want you to say this to him. I have a message for you from Poirot. He says, find the extra coffee cup, and you can rest in peace. Nothing more, nothing less.
Find the extra coffee cup, and you can rest in peace. Is that right?
I asked, much mystified.
Excellent.
But what does it mean?
Ah, that I will leave you to find out.
You have access to the facts. Just say that to him, and see what he says.
Very well, but it's all extremely mysterious.
We were running into Tadminster now, and Poirot directed the car to the analytical chemist. Poirot hopped down briskly and went inside. In a few minutes he was back again.
There, he said. That is all my business.
What were you doing in there? I asked in lively curiosity.
I left something to be analyzed.
Well, yes, but what?
The sample of cocoa I took from the saucepan in the bedroom.
But that has already been tested, I cried, stupefied. Dr. Bauerstein had it tested, and you yourself laughed at the possibility of there being strychnine in it.
I know Dr. Bauerstein had it tested, replied Poirot quietly.
Well, then?
Well, I have a fancy for having it analyzed again. That is all.
And not another word on the subject could I drag out of him. This proceeding of Poirot's in respect of the cocoa puzzled me intensely. I could see neither rhyme nor reason in it. However, my confidence in him, which at one time had rather waned, was fully restored, since his belief in Alfred Inglethorpe's innocence had been so triumphantly vindicated. The funeral of Mrs. Inglethorpe took place the following day, and on Monday, as I came down to a late breakfast, John drew me aside and informed me that Mr. Inglethorpe was leaving that morning to take up his quarters at the Stylites Arms until he should have completed his plans.
And really, it's a great relief to think he's going, Hastings, continued my honest friend. It was bad enough before, when we thought he'd done it, but I'm hanged if it isn't worse now, when we all feel guilty for having been so down on the fellow. The fact is, we've treated him abominably.
Of course, things did look black against him. I don't see how anyone could blame us for jumping to the conclusions we did. Still, there it is. We were in the wrong, and now there's a beastly feeling that one ought to make amends, which is difficult when one doesn't like the fellow a bit better than one did before. The whole thing's damned awkward. And I'm thankful he's had the tact to take himself off. It's a good thing Styles wasn't the mater's to leave to him. Couldn't bear to think of the fellow lording it here.
He's welcome to her money.
You'll be able to keep up the place, all right? I asked.
Oh, yes. There are death duties, of course. But half my father's money goes with the place. And Lawrence will stay with us for the present, so there is his share as well. We shall be pinched at first, of course, because as I once told you, I'm in a bit of a hole financially myself. Still, the Johnnies will wait now.
In the general relief at Inglethorpe's approaching departure, we had the most genial breakfast we had experienced since the tragedy. Cynthia, whose young spirits were naturally buoyant, was looking quite her pretty self again, and we all, with the exception of Lawrence, who seemed unutterably gloomy and nervous, were quietly cheerful at the opening of a new and hopeful future. The papers, of course, had been full of the tragedy. Glaring headlines, sandwiched biographies of every member of the household, subtle innuendos, the usual familiar tag about the police having a clue. Nothing was spared us. It was a slack time. The war was momentarily inactive, and the newspapers seized with avidity on this crime in fashionable life. The mysterious affair at Styles was the topic of the moment. Naturally, it was very annoying for the Cavendishes. The house was constantly besieged by reporters, who were consistently denied admission but who continued to haunt the village and the grounds, where they lay in wait with cameras for any unwary members of the household. We all lived in a blast of publicity. The Scotland Yard men came and went, examining, questioning, lynx-eyed and reserved of tongue. Towards what end they were working, we did not know. Had they any clue? Or would the whole thing remain in the category of undiscovered crimes? After breakfast, Dorcas came up to me rather mysteriously and asked if she might have a few words with me. Oh, certainly. What is it, Dorcas?
Well, it's just this, sir. You'll be seeing the Belgian gentleman today, perhaps?
I nodded.
Well, sir, you know how he asked me so particular if the mistress, or anyone else, had a green dress?
Yes, yes. You have found one?
My interest was aroused. No, not that, sir. But since then I've remembered what the young gentleman—
John and Lawrence were still the young gentleman to Dorcas—
call the dressing-up box. It's up in the front attic, sir. A great chest full of old clothes and fancy dresses and what not. And it came to me sudden-like that there might be a green dress amongst them. So, if you'd tell the Belgian gentleman—
I will tell him, Dorcas, I promised.
Thank you very much, sir. Very nice gentleman he is, sir. And quite a different class from them two detectives from London, what goes prying about and asking questions. I don't hold with foreigners, as a rule. But from what the newspaper says, I make out as how these brave Belgies isn't the ordinary run of foreigners, and certainly he's a most polite-spoken gentleman.
Dear old Dorcas. As she stood there with her honest face upturned to mine, I thought what a fine specimen she was of the old-fashioned servant that is so fast dying out. I thought I might as well go down to the village at once and look up Poirot, but I met him halfway coming up to the house and at once gave him Dorcas's message.
Ah! The brave Dorcas. We will look at the chest, although—
But no matter. We will examine it all the same. We entered the house by one of the windows. There was no one in the hall, and we went straight up to the attic. Sure enough, there was the chest. A fine old piece, all studded with brass nails and full to overflowing with every imaginable type of garment. Poirot bundled everything out on the floor with scant ceremony. There were one or two green fabrics of varying shades, but Poirot shook his head over them all. He seemed somewhat apathetic in the search, as though he expected no great results from it. Suddenly, he gave an exclamation.
What is it?
Look!
The chest was nearly empty, and there, reposing right at the bottom, was a magnificent black beard.
Oh-ho! Said Poirot. Oh-ho!
He turned it over in his hands, examining it closely.
New, he remarked.
Yes, quite new. After a moment's hesitation, he replaced it in the chest, heaped all the other things on top of it as before, and made his way briskly downstairs. He went straight to the pantry, where we found Dorcas busily polishing her silver. Poirot wished her good morning with Gallic politeness, and went on.
We have been looking through that chest, Dorcas. I'm much obliged to you for mentioning it. There is indeed a fine collection there. Are they often used, may I ask?
Well, sir, not very often nowadays, though from time to time we do have what the young gentlemen call a dress-up night. And very funny it is sometimes, sir. Mr. Lawrence, he's wonderful. Most comic. I shall never forget the night he came down as the Char of Persia, I think he called it. A sort of Eastern King it was. He had a big paper knife in his hand, and... Mind, Dorcas, he says, you'll have to be very respectful. This is my specially sharpened scimitar, and it's off with your head if I'm at all displeased with you. Miss Cynthia, she was what they call an Apache, or some such name. A Frenchified sort of cutthroat, I take it to be. A real sight she looked. You'd never have believed a pretty young lady like that could have made herself into such a ruffian. Nobody would have known her.
These evenings must have been great fun, said Poirot genially. I suppose Mr. Lawrence wore that fine black beard in the chest upstairs, or when he was Shah of Persia.
He did have a beard, sir, replied Dorcas, smiling. And well I know it, for he borrowed 2 skeins of my black wool to make it with, and I'm sure it looked wonderfully natural at a distance. I didn't know as there was a beard up there at all. It must have been got quite lately, I think. There was a red wig, I know, but nothing else in the way of hair.
Burnt corks they use mostly, though 'tis messy getting it off again.
So, Dorcas knows nothing about that black beard, said Poirot thoughtfully, as we walked out into the hall again. Do you think it's the one? I whispered eagerly. Poirot nodded.
I do. You noticed it had been trimmed?
No. Yes. It was cut exactly the shape of Mr. Inglethorpe's, and I found one or two snipped hairs. Hastings, this affair is very deep. Who put it in the chest, I wonder?
Someone with a good deal of intelligence, remarked Poirot dryly. You realize that he chose the one place in the house to hide it where its presence would not be remarked.
Yes, he is intelligent, but we must be more intelligent. We must be so intelligent that he does not suspect us of being intelligent at all. I acquiesced.
There, mon ami, you will be of great assistance to me.
I was pleased with the compliment. There had been times when I hardly thought Poirot appreciated me at my true worth.
Yes, he continued, staring at me thoughtfully, you will be invaluable.
This was naturally gratifying, but Poirot's next words were not so welcome.
I must have an ally in the house, he observed reflectively.
Well, you have me, I protested.
True, but you are not sufficient.
I was hurt and showed it. Poirot hurried to explain himself.
No, you do not quite take my meaning. You are known to be working with me. I want somebody who is not associated with us in any way.
Oh, I see. Well, how about John?
No, I think not.
The dear fellow isn't perhaps very bright, I said thoughtfully.
Here comes Miss Howard, said Poirot suddenly. She is the very person.
But I am in her black books, since I cleared Mr. Inglethorpe. Still, we can but try. With a nod that was barely civil, Miss Howard assented to Poirot's request for a few minutes' conversation. We went into the little morning room, and Poirot closed the door.
Well, Monsieur Poirot, said Miss Howard impatiently, what is it? Out with it, I'm busy.
Do you remember, mademoiselle, that I once asked you to help me?
Yes, I do, the lady nodded, and I told you I'd help you with pleasure, to hang Alfred Inglethorpe.
Ah,
Poirot studied her seriously.
Miss Howard, I will ask you one question. I beg of you to reply to it truthfully.
Never tell lies, replied Miss Howard.
It is this. Do you still believe that Mrs. Inglethorpe was poisoned by her husband?
What do you mean? She asked sharply. You needn't think your pretty explanations influence me in the slightest. I'll admit that it wasn't he who bought strychnine at the chemist's shop. What of that? I dare say he soaked flypaper, as I told you at the beginning.
That is arsenic, not strychnine, said Poirot mildly.
What does it matter? Arsenic would put poor Emily out of the way just as well as strychnine. If I'm convinced he did it, it doesn't matter a jot to me how he did it.
Exactly. If you are convinced he did it, said Poirot quietly, I will put my question in another form. Did you ever in your heart of hearts believe that Mrs. Inglethorpe was poisoned by her husband?
Good heavens, cried Miss Howard. Haven't I always told you the man is a villain? Haven't I always told you he would murder her in her bed? Haven't I always hated him like poison?
Exactly, said Poirot. That bears out my little idea entirely.
What little idea?
Miss Howard, do you remember a conversation that took place on the day of my friend's arrival here? He repeated it to me, and there is a sentence of yours that has impressed me very much. Do you remember affirming that if a crime had been committed, and anyone you loved had been murdered, you felt certain that you would know by instinct who the criminal was, even if you were quite unable to prove it?
Yes, I remember saying that. I believe it, too. I suppose you think it's nonsense.
Not at all.
And yet you will pay no attention to my instinct against Alfred Inglethorpe.
No, said Poirot curtly, because your instinct is not against Mr. Inglethorpe.
What?
No. You wish to believe he committed the crime. You believe him capable of committing it. But your instinct tells you he did not commit it. It tells you more. Shall I go on?
She was staring at him, fascinated, and made a slight affirmative movement of the hand.
Shall I tell you why you have been so vehement against Mr. Inglethorpe? It is because you have been trying to believe what you wish to believe.
it is because you are trying to drown and stifle your instinct, which tells you another name.
No, 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 cried Miss Howard, wildly flinging up her hands. Don't say it. No, don't say it. It isn't true. It can't be true. I don't know what put such a wild, such a dreadful idea into my head.
I am right, am I not? Asked Poirot.
Yes, yes.
You must be a wizard to have guessed. But it can't be so. It's so monstrous, too impossible. It must be Alfred Inglethorpe. Poirot shook his head gravely.
Don't ask me about it, continued Miss Howard, because I shan't tell you. I won't admit it, even to myself. I must be mad to think of such a thing.
Poirot nodded, as if satisfied.
I will ask you nothing. It is enough for me that it is as I thought. And I too have an instinct. We are working together towards a common end.
Don't ask me to help you, because I won't. I wouldn't lift a finger to...
She faltered.
You will help me, in spite of yourself. I ask you nothing, but you will be my ally. You will not be able to help yourself. You will do the only thing that I want of you.
And that is?
You will watch.
Evelyn Howard bowed her head.
Yes, I can't help doing that. I'm always watching, always hoping I shall be proved wrong.
If we are wrong, well and good, said Poirot. No one will be more pleased than I shall. But if we are right...
If we are right, Miss Howard, on whose side are you then?
I don't know. I don't know.
Come now.
It could be hushed up.
There must be no hushing up.
But Emily herself...
She broke off.
Miss Howard, said Poirot gravely, that is unworthy of you.
Suddenly, she took her face from her hands.
Yes,
she said quietly. That was not Evelyn Howard who spoke. She flung her head up proudly.
This is Evelyn Howard, and she is on the side of justice. Let the cost be what it may.
And with these words, she walked firmly out of the room.
There, said Poirot, looking after her, goes a very valuable ally. That woman, Hastings, has got brains, as well as a heart.
I did not reply.
Instinct is a marvelous thing, mused Poirot. It can neither be explained nor ignored.
Well, you and Miss Howard seem to know what you are talking about, I observed coldly. Perhaps you don't realize that I'm still in the dark.
Oh, really? Is that so, mon ami?
Yes.
Enlighten me, will you?
Poirot studied me attentively for a moment or two, then, to my intense surprise, he shook his head decidedly.
No, my friend.
Oh, look here. Why not?
Two is enough for a secret.
Well, I think it's very unfair to keep back facts from me.
I am not keeping back facts. Every fact that I know is in your possession. You can draw your own deductions from them. This time, it is a question of ideas.
Still, it would be interesting to know.
Poirot looked at me very earnestly, and again shook his head.
You see, he said sadly, you have no instincts.
It was intelligence you were acquiring just now, I pointed out.
The two often go together, said Poirot enigmatically.
The remark seemed so utterly irrelevant that I did not even take the trouble to answer it. But I decided that if I made any interesting and important discoveries, as no doubt I should, I would keep them to myself and surprise Poirot with the ultimate result. There are times when it's one's duty to assert oneself.